This is the beginning of tape two, the interview with Professor J. Carroll Bonham. It's done 14 July, 89. You were saying that we've just changed the tape here. You were just saying that you think maybe we made a little bit of progress?
Yes, I think we've made a little progress. But not a great amount. If you look around the world, the various nations of the world, a good share of them have some program to control a crop output. They have tended in the main to leave livestock free because it's very difficult to control the output of livestock. But we have had various kinds of programs, and I suspect we will have an agricultural program for quite a while, because agriculture is subject to cycles, mm-hmm. oversupply and undersupply because of weather, and it's pretty difficult for the farmer to stand these wide swings. And the public is also interested in a stable supply of agricultural products. And you put those two things together, and I suspect we'll have something that will try to stabilize the output and the price for quite some time.
The farm population has been declining in Indiana over the years. If you project into the future, who's going to be left farming the land in Indiana? Will it be just large corporations, or?
Well, I think there'll be some corporations, as there is now, and maybe a little increase, but I think they will be largely large farmers, much larger than now. Mm-hmm. And that trend will continue. And with that trend, we will also have probably a trend in which people buy small farms and live out in the country and grow a few crops and a little livestock, but get their earnings from urban business. Mm-hmm. So we'll have those two trends. The farm continued, the farm's getting larger, and others continuing small as rural residences.
As I read about more and more people leaving the farms, not just Indiana, but throughout the country, I ask myself the question, who's going to produce the foodstuffs for the people of this nation and for the export for those who can't feed themselves?
Yeah. Well, of course, we're reducing the labor required. One time it used to take half an hour labor to produce a bushel of corn. Now we do it in 1 to 2 minutes.
Really?
That's right. And so you see, it just doesn't take as many to do it. We've had a great growth in efficiency in agriculture. It's been free enough to grow and develop and move forward in our society. It's been one of the outstanding industries in that respect. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll continue to get more efficient.
There's one area that we haven't explored yet, which is very important, and it's a name with which it's an idea, it's a part of extension work and part of agricultural economics with which your name is quite closely associated, and that's community development. Could you tell us more about that concept? What was its background? When did it come into being?
Well, the idea of community planning has risen its political head three times, really four now. Back in the 30s, we had, sponsored by the federal government, with Congress's support, the idea of analyzing how the land should be used in the country. And we had land use committees set up in every county, and we mapped every county in Indiana. And farmers drew the lines of how they thought the land should be farmed in the various small sections of the county.
You mean what crops should be produced?
Good crops should be grown to maintain the land. Then that kind of died down. Then we had a second interest in the part of Congress to do something about community development. And we got started again, and then that kind of declined. All the time in Indiana, though, we were doing a little more of it. And then, along about the 60s, late 60s, there was another appropriation of funds and interest in doing community development. Because the people in Congress looked at these communities and said that they had the same problem of organizing their county activities and making them more efficient as we did out on the farm. How to provide the health services better. How to get business to come to an area. And how to do organize the schools. And so they encouraged the setting up of committees to do this. And we in Indiana set up a program that was somewhat unique. We would go out to a county after they voted to go ahead with it, the extension program committee in the county, and we would interview the major organizations in that county, all of them, the major ones, and ask them who they were the people that they would suggest that should be on such a committee if we set up a long-run county planning development committee. Farm Bureau, I'm talking about organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, the labor unions, whoever was there. Now we would usually have a list then maybe of 60, 70 people that would come up. Then we would go and visit those people for an hour or two, and we'd talk about the problems of the county, what they thought they were, and we'd ask them to give us three names of people that they thought were good thinkers and were broad-minded and fair people that should be on such a committee if it was set up. Now this took quite a lot of time. The county agent and one of us from Purdue went, in most cases. Then we would get quite a list there. And there would be some names that would come up that had never come up, many names that never come up by that first group's. So then we would go and visit them and ask them the same question. Now when we got all through, we might have 150 names. And we'd look to see what names were recommended most often. And the ones that were recommended most often, we would ask them to serve on the Community Development Committee. And we would have set up a committee of somewhere around from 15 to 30 in the county to look at the law, what they thought were the things that had happened in the county that had been good, what they thought ought to happen, should happen, and how it came about and how they might bring it about.
You had a map of the influence structure in the county, didn't
you? We did, and we had probably at one time 20 to 30 of the counties with such committees. We had one in Lake County, that Bud Lowers, the county agent, and I set up with all their diverse population. And it is still operating. And that was set up before I retired in the 60s. And they have done some very interesting things. And some of these other counties are still going to some extent. Then, here at Purdue, Dean Coles decided that we should set up a group called Community Development. And I was made the first chairman of that Community Development group. And I visited with the heads of the departments. And all the departments but two thought they were interested and should have a representative on our College of Agriculture committee. And we set up such a committee here, and they had in charge of the problem of developing a educational program here at the institution. Research and graduate program, which they did. And then when I retired, Henry Wadsworth became the Director of Community Development. At the present time, Bob Jones is Director of Community Development. Mm-hmm. And they were in charge of the program out in extension in the field.
You mentioning earlier about Lake County. I believe at some point you invested quite a bit of time in developing programs in Lake County. Was it specifically with respect to community development?
Yes, yes, yes.
Was this to develop Lake County as sort of a laboratory learning concept? Or?
Well, it was one of the areas that had a lot of people, a share of Indiana citizens, and it was an area that had a lot of problems. And so, and it was a problem, an area where the president had a little question about her doing
it. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why
and so, Dieslin, who was director of extension, said then to him, well, will you want you give us a chance to try?
And the president you're referring to is?
President Purdue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which president would this have been at that time? In the 60s, probably Hufty.
Yeah, I'd be Hufty, I believe. Yeah. Hufty and Hicks were over there. And so they gave us a chance to try. And we visited those people. And we got visited the Latinos, the Latins, quite a lot. The blacks. The Catholic Church was very important. The steel companies and the oil companies were very important. And we set up a committee. Now, we had a little, we had a problem. Everybody said in the county that if we had, such a committee, we had to have a representative of the Catholic Church. And it couldn't be just an individual picked at random. He had to represent the church because they had such a structure. Mm-hmm. So we met with the bishop, and he appointed a Monsignor, who was on the committee. We had a little trouble in the steel area, and we went to Pittsburgh and got them to appoint the man. And likewise in
well,
oil.
You didn't take no for an answer,
oh,
did
no.
You?
We worked for... We were, took plenty of time. Probably we were at it for a year setting up this committee. Mm-hmm. And when we got the committee set up, we had a some organization made a study in there and said we really had the influence leaders of Lake County. Mm-hmm. We had a very influential committee. We had the top man in Steele, we had the we had a high-ranking labor man, was a very fine fellow, and oil, and then we had some very important real estate lawyers, architects, and we only had about three or four farmers on it because the population was of this nature. And I remember so well, the one of the men that came the top at that time was the Chamber of Commerce secretary at East Chicago. And he was a very influential man in the county. And he said, who's going to make the agenda for this committee? And we said, the people are. Well, he said, if you will let the Lake County people do it now, you really do it, I'll be a member. And we did. And he was a very effective member. But we had to be real, business-like and pretty hard-boiled about it.
Mm-hmm. You said Secretary of Commerce, was this somebody in the state government of Indiana?
Secretary of the Chamber of Commerce.
Secretary of the Chamber of Commerce.
For East Chicago.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Now, for those who are not familiar with the geography of Indiana, this would be, what, in the upper northwest corner?
Corner, northwest
state?
Corner. It included East Chicago, Hammond, Gary, and for example, Thatcher, who was mayor of Gary for a number of years, was one of the people we interviewed. We had a black councilman. We had the assistant head of the schools in Gary, was a very fine, effective man on it. We had a druggist that was a doctor. We had a great time getting the leadership in the Latin areas, but we finally got a fellow that was a doctor and a public-spirited fellow. And so we had all areas represented pretty well.
Really illustrates the concept that ag extension is not just agriculture, but it's much more broad in terms of the programs.
Yes. Yes, we had some problems with the Farm Bureau that we were broadening out into other areas.
And the Farm Bureau wasn't comfortable
with
that?
Wasn't comfortable, some of them. Now, some of them were, but some of them were not comfortable with that. Mm. But they went along, because we said we were working on the problems of the communities.
Mm-hmm. And you chose Lake County?
As a good, if we could do it there, we could do it anywhere.
Uh-huh. Who made the decision to focus on Lake County as a starter there? Was that your decision?
Well, I you ask a question I can't recall now. I don't know who really decided. I think probably we did over here in the community development group.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of extension went along with the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Was Dieslin then.
Mm-hmm. How do you spell that?
Dieslin. D I S. I'll have to look that up.
We'll look it up later.
Yeah.
Okay. Is community development and rural development, are those the same concepts?
Yeah, they're the same concepts. Yeah.
Okay.
Same concept. And really what you're trying to do is to make the units of government more efficient,
mm-hmm,
and more applicable to the people of the community. Just like you are in farming. You're trying to develop the enterprises on the farm and make them efficient and into the whole, and you're trying to do that for the community. The only difference, instead of one individual, you're dealing with a mass of individuals. See?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem of working out a process for getting them together. And when we had a problem, of what to do about a particular issue, we'd use the public policy model that's there the same as we would in a national to get them to discuss it. And like in Lake County, they had certain problems, and they would have seminars and bring in speakers and have people come. And their committee up there has been very active. I think they're still doing it. They have an annual meeting, which they'll bring in an outstanding person from the United States on community development, and maybe have a couple hundred people there. And we have a person that works full time up there on community development now, still do.
Your travels around the globe and your work in the state and our conversation has really illustrated to me that an ag economist, somebody who works in extension and provides service to the state and the community, needs some special skills, some special perspectives that you certainly wouldn't necessarily predict just intuitively if you were going to go out and set up a curriculum yourself. What do you think are some of those most important components of the in the education, in the making of an agricultural economist, based on
well,
your career?
I think that he needs to be familiar with the area of his work. If he's going to work in rural area, he must understand the values of the people, and he must understand the industry so that he can fit the economics and contributions he's going to make into their value system. And of course, in our day, it was very helpful to have somebody that was brought up on the farm, that was sensitive and understood farming in the rural communities. In Gary, it was somebody that understood communities and were sensitive, if you're going in that kind of an area, to the people, the people's problems, and knew human nature and how they responded, rather than just the figures. And this takes a certain special type person. Now later on, the university under Hansen and decided to set up a coordinating committee for public policy in the university. And they asked me to be chairman of a committee.
Was this the Center for Public Policy that existed?
Yeah, that was established from the Center for Public Policy. And so I had retired then. They've made me chairman, and M. Weiler from this school, associate dean over in engineering, and a fellow from political science, and I've forgotten one other, there's five of them. And we worked out a program which we recommended. And it was adopted with maybe minor modifications, except for one thing, which I wrote to the president about it and wrote to the vice chairman of the university. They never, in their early stages, got an individual that was dedicated and had this sensitivity that it took to develop such a program. First two or three looked upon it as a stepping stone. Yes, they'd take it and then they'd run off to something else. And they didn't understand. I tried to point out to them the art of making this go, as much as the structure was in getting the individual that understood it, which they never got, unless the last one is doing better, I don't know. You have to have people that are sensitive to people's values and that are good analysts too. And that are dedicated. Because I remember in Lake County, we used to be lower than snake bellies sometimes. And then we'd be high other times, see. In setting up the committee and getting it to operate.
This was a mission unlike the rest of the universities in the state, wasn't it? I mean, did Indiana University have any such program?
No, they don't have an extension program, of course.
Throughout our conversation, the word values and people, the importance of understanding people has come up, and as I reflect on our conversation, I'm thinking about making policy and so the values and the principles implicit in this country, concepts of equality and being fair, as important ingredients in making public policy.
Yes. Yes.
Do you have any additional thoughts on that?
Well, I've come to a philosophy that I think is sound and would be true if I was in France or England or Germany or where. Or Africa, where I have been, and I am quite sure it's just as true there as it is here. And that is that as a result of our environment and our heredity, I don't want to get in the argument which is which and how much is one, but because of them, that we have individuals that have very widely varying capabilities. And thus, the people get rewarded on a wide different basis if you have a free enterprise capitalistic system. Now, if you have a society, in our society, we put a lot of emphasis on justice and equality in this country, and most societies do. But if we have a society where everyone gets the same income, then the productivity of that country tends to fall to the level of the lowest producer. And everybody has less. We've seen this so dramatically in Russia and China recently. But long before this, it became evident to me that this was true as I traveled about the world. So, to make a society livable, you have to keep as much free enterprise as you can, and people are awarded towards it according to their abilities, but you have to cushion it. So you have a little justice, too. And you have to have special programs to take care of the handicapped, of course, and then those that are weaker and less capable. But to the extent that you have, you need to develop them so that they encourage that individual to do his best and to get off from them if he can. And that runs through all our social problems of our society, and I think needs to be kept in mind in developing policy. I don't think that's political. I think it's just is the art of finding a balance for that society at its time in history and its attitude towards what's justice and equal may vary with time, but there is a level at which they think is it represents justice at various times.
That's a pretty tall order, isn't it?
Pretty tall order. Pretty tall order. But I wish we could get all our legislators to recognize that this basic fact. Because then if they did, as they work upon the individual programs, they could develop them to the point that needs to develop, but not make them so they're restrictive and stymie that area.
I don't think we've, speaking of legislature, I don't know, have we spoken about any contacts you may have had with the legislature, any assignments by the state governments, for example?
Well,
have you been asked to testify?
I've testified in Washington 2 or 3 times on bills, and worked in Washington some. And when I was at the Farm Bureau, I was down there quite a little. Now, at the state level, Kohlmeyer was a state and local government man, and he was in the legislature a great deal. He worked on state and local government, see?
This is J.B. Kohlmeyer.
J.B. Kohlmeyer.
Uh-huh.
And then he got Huey working in there.
John Huey.
John Huey. And Huey worked in there. And, of course, became budget director there, you know. And Kohlmeyer...
Dr. Huey's current position, I think, is vice president for...
of university in charge of...
state relations.
State relations, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, but Kohlmeyer was very active in state problems. Of course, as I said, as a result of our educational programs on school reorganization, he became the director of school reorganization. But I didn't work at the, only at times did I work at the local level, on local problems, till I got in community development. I worked at the national level, and then he took the state problem, local problems. And the various individuals, some of them took them, see, and some took the national. Dunbar, for example, worked with me on the national, and Wadsworth and others.
Did Dr. Wadsworth, did he get his degree from Purdue? Start his...
Cornell.
His degree is from Cornell.
At Cornell.
I see. The reason I ask is I'm thinking of, for example, Huey, I believe, got his degree.
Got his degree here, yes, yeah, yeah.
Have you, can you think of, you know, this is no time to be modest, can you think of people whose careers in this field you helped to shape and influence, people that you've mentored?
Well, at our national policy conference, which we went to every year for 30 years, yes, I was president of it 2 different times at 2-year periods. I think we influenced a lot of people in their extension programs throughout the United States. In my graduate class, I had people that went on that I'm sure I influenced. We had a fellow named, one of my fellows wrote his thesis with me, Bryce Meeker, later became...
Meaker?
Yeah. Bryce Meeker. He later became attaché in Moscow, and he was attaché in the common for the common market in The Hague, and then he was attaché in Australia, probably the best agricultural attaché in Europe. Considered, he was one of my old students, and I know that I influenced him some. I used to visit him over there. My last graduate student, Barry Flinchbaugh, F-L-I-N-C-H-B-A-U-G-H, in charge of the extension program in Kansas, was very much influenced by our program and is continuing on the presentation of the policies that we developed here as a result of this. And we have many others.
I was talking this morning with Bob Jones and
yes.
with Oscar, what's Oscar's
Oscar name? Hopkins.
Oscar Hopkins, who have assured me that directly or indirectly all of the agricultural extension agents of this state, or at least one generation past, have been in some way touched by your work and your thinking,
yes.
your speaking and your publishing.
Yes, we had a very great respect from the county agents. They worked with us exceedingly well, and they would set up these regional meetings, and they would get the right people in, most of them. Some of the poorer ones would slip a little, but and Hopkins was one of the good ones, and he was very good in, he was county agent, became county agent in Indianapolis, but he also was a community development man for several years. He has that ability to sense people's values and can work with them very effectively, whether they're head of a big corporation or whether they're a farmer out here in the country. That's what you got to have, that you can relate to all of them.
Your career has been filled with achievement, and your colleagues throughout the country have recognized you in many ways. For example, you've been awarded the title of Kentucky Colonel in 1975. You've been given an honorary Master Farmer award. You were made honorary Master Farmer by the Prairie Farmer in 1972.
I wrote for the Prairie Farmer for quite a number of years, and I wrote for the Capper's Farmer and several other publications.
Mm-hmm. You received the Career Recognition Award from Cooperative Extension Specialist Associations in 1970. You made a Sagamore of the Wabash by Governor Whitcomb. Roughly when would that have been?
Well, that would have been about 1970. Wayne Townsend, the new trustee of Purdue University, presented it to me. Mm-hmm. He was a Democrat, and the governor was Republican, and Wayne presented it to me at a meeting of our Farm Policy Study Group.
Uh-huh. You were presented an award by the Federal Land Bank of Louisville for outstanding contribution to American agriculture, presented the Golden Anniversary Session. You received a Certificate of Distinction by Agriculture Alumni in 1965. You were made Hillenbrand Distinguished Professor at Purdue in July of 69. You've been given several honorary doctorates,
mm-hmm.
one from South Dakota State, an honorary Doctor of Science degree that was in June of 1969. You've also been given an honorary, an honorary Doctor of Agriculture degree by Purdue in 1972. In 1960, you were recognized with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Superior Service Award. There wouldn't be enough tape to read all of the recognitions and distinctions that have been associated with you and which have characterized your career. As you think back on your many accomplishments, which of those in particular are you most proud of that gave you most satisfaction?
Well, I think that the one I would have to put first was the satisfaction I gained from having the respect of the farmers in Indiana and the public policy leaders that I gained over the years, and they had nothing but knowledge to give them, and they were not interested in anything but improving themselves, and the satisfaction of seeing them develop and appreciate it, and having their appreciation, I presume would be the number one. You know, they would come to our meetings, wouldn't have anything to eat, we couldn't give them any money, nothing but knowledge, Why would a fellow come unless he was really interested in improving himself, see? And that's the kind of people associated with, and that was a great pleasure and great honor that I had over the years, and I made so many of them. I had a little incident that happened about 4 years ago. I was sitting in my office and a senior came in and he said, I'm graduating this year and I just wanted to come in and visit with you. I didn't know him, didn't remember him. And he visited a while. And then he got up to go. He says, you know, I came in here because of my father. He said, a number of years ago, you were keeping farm accountants on the farm. And he said, as you left the last time, you put your arm around him and said, John, you ought to be raising twice as many hogs as you are. And he said he did. And that's the reason I'm here.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
It was quite a surprise. I'd forgotten the man, see?
Yeah.
And I didn't know remember his son.
You've touched the lives of lots of people.
Yeah. Well, you some of those come back to you, you know. Yeah. I have never seen him since.
Mm-hmm. Some of the people that you've had contact with who... you're not quite sure if they were aware of the contributions that you had made and that your colleagues made to come back later.
Yes, you never know. You never know whether you influenced them or not.
I noticed this book by Kenneth L. Robinson. I'd spent a long time at Cornell myself in the industrial relations area, so Robinson's name is well known on campus.
Yes, he's a very capable individual.
Yes, yes. He came, I believe, for a conference one time, or how did you meet him?
Well, he came from Harvard, was hired by Cornell when Frosty Hill was chairman of the department. And I had been working with Hill a good deal in the national committee. We were on the national committee together, and he knew what we were doing out in Indiana. So he asked Ken Robinson to come out and spend a week and go to a week, four meetings, day meetings, series with Kohlmeyer and myself. Sent him out and paid his expenses to come out here and do it. And he did. And so he attended those meetings when we were holding policy on agricultural programs and had the chance to see us and the audience in action. And he was a little critical the first day, pretty critical, I'd say. The next day, he wasn't quite as critical. But he never really expressed himself what he really did think until this book came out.
The book that we're looking at here together is by Kenneth L. Robinson. The title is Farm and Food Policies and Their Consequences. And let's just read a short paragraph from the
And that's preface. That's an 89 book.
It just came right out, that's
yeah.
right.
Yeah, just came out.
1989 imprint. Robinson's giving credit to many people here, and he says, I am indebted to many individuals, including former professors and students, for their ideas and indoctrination on how to approach policy issues. I owe much to F.F. Hill, who taught the course I inherited in 1952. His enthusiasm for the subject and many of his ideas have remained a part of me for 35 years. J. Carroll Bottom and J.B. Kohlmeyer, both associated with Purdue University, at an early stage in my professional career, impressed on me the virtue of outlining the alternatives and assessing the consequences in educating the public about policy issues.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's as fitting a tribute as any.
Yeah. Very, very satisfying.
To sort of sum up our talk here, our conversation, are there any just closing thoughts you might have?
Yes, I would say that in my tenure at Purdue University, over the 40-some years that I was here, that I had worked under about a dozen different heads of departments, directors of extension and deans and presidents, which had something to do with directing me, that I found that I could say about all of them that I think they were all dedicated to do a good as good a job as they could in the light of the way they saw their job. And it was generally pretty good. Not always as I would have chosen, but I felt that they were really dedicated to their task and trying to do their best. And I remember once when the policy was pretty warm of the President Hovde saying to me, "We'll stand behind you as long as you stay with the facts." Uh-huh. Well, it was an old Dean Skinner was might give you a heck, but when the chips were down, he was back of you. Mm-hmm. If you performed as an educator. Mm-hmm. And so I feel very fortunate. Roy Huffman was a great director of extension. He let the people out in the state plan their programs, what they wanted. And he respected people when they carried out programs that satisfied them. Earl Butz was good in that he kind of broke the way for you, and he kind of let you go. He didn't clamp down on you. But they were all in their way with trying to do their best.
I said at the outset that this has impressed me as a very distinguished department, and certainly I understand better the department and the people who have carved out their careers in the department from this opportunity to get to know you, because you're a very distinguished person yourself. And
well, we always had a fine relationship. We used to be over in Ag Hall, and Eve Goebel, I don't know whether you've ever met her or not, she was head of home economics.
No.
Still living here. She was head of the extension and the home economics extension. She said, "We go down the hall and we can hear the ag economic boys in there at their meeting just fighting like dogs and cats." she would tell this to her girls. And she'd say, "And then, by Jove, we look at them and then they all go out and play golf together." Now, she said, "We women have got to get like that." She says, "We get going, somebody makes a crack about somebody's hat, and then everybody's mad," she says. And it was really true. We just really fight, almost, over issues. Mm-hmm. And that was glory days, because we weren't arguing about what the dang computer was doing right or not. We were arguing whether that was sound economic principle or not for this situation, see. And we always had a policy that if we couldn't agree, we made a bet of a Coke. That's all it was, and wrote it up on the wall. Now, we weren't interested in the Coke, but we were interested in convincing that guy that he was wrong, see?
Uh-huh.
And he had to fess up to it by buying the Coke. And that made for strong people. They didn't like to lose too much Coke because they were losing prestige, see?
Uh-huh.
That wasn't the Coke, but it was the prestige they were losing.
Major resources were at stake there, huh?
Yeah, were at stake. And we had many times. I remember Dick Coles, who remember you've met him, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, definitely.
We had Vaughn and Noah Hadley, and they were both quite determined. They didn't just get in the bitterest arguments. And Hadley was an extension man. He'd go out and he'd observe these things happening 100 times. Then he'd come in and make a statement about it. Cole said, you haven't got a bit of evidence. Well, Hadley knew in his mind he had 100 cases, but he didn't have anything written down, see? And Coles was right, he didn't have any evidence, see,
uh-huh.
that could, and boy, that would make Hadley mad. But you see, it drove Hadley to get evidence.
Uh-huh.
Yeah? And that was the kind of thing that went on. I'll fix him. I'll have the evidence. We'll make a survey.
That's what universities are for, aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, that's what they're for.
Yeah.
And it was a university. Now we had a fella that was all those early years that was head by the name of Lloyd. Lloyd was couldn't reason economically at all. He was a Mormon, but he was a fine man. And he would let other people argue, and he'd let us have higher income than he made as head of the department, see? And so when he retired, even though he just was very weak in economics, knew any economics, they were having an argument over there in the R.B. Stewart, which was controller of the university one day, having an argument over there. And they said, who's the best head of the department? Are you getting this?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know. Who was the best head of the department? And R.B. Stewart said, Lloyd. Well, they all kind of poo-pooed. And they said, well, who left the best department when he died or when he left? Well, they agreed Lloyd did. See? And I wasn't particularly strong about how you measure a guy. And I always thought about that. And Lloyd did leave a good department when he died, when he left here. But came in his head. But E.C. Young was a strong, very strong man.
E.C.
Young.
Young. Uh-huh.
And he later became dean of the graduate school. He was the one that impressed me a great deal over my life, too, I think. We'd have, you'd have an argument down here between two fellas, and Doc could reach up here and get a picture that was big enough to take you both in, see? Mm-hmm. And you could see he was broad enough. He could take both of you in.
Was he one of your professors here or at
He
Illinois?
Was a professor here.
Huh.
Came from Cornell.
Uh-huh.
Outstanding.
E period, C period, Young.
Yeah. He was not a doctrinaire, or was he very formal, very informal. But nice looking, big fella, and right about most things. Right.
Something I can't resist asking you. I take it one of your close friends and colleagues was J.B. Goldmeyer.
Yeah.
He had a nickname called
Heavy.
Heavy.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, he was fat and weighed 250 pounds.
Oh, my Lord.
Or 260. 280 sometimes.
I see.
It
wasn't the weight of his economic logic.
Oh, no. We went to a meeting once, I remember. Original meeting, before we could start the meeting, there was another big fellow there, and they all got in an argument which was the heaviest. We had to take them both out and weigh them before we could start the meeting. That's the way Heavy was. Undisciplined, undependable. I couldn't depend on him for anything. But very perceptive. And when he'd get out to county, first thing he'd do was buy every paper, and he'd read those papers. What was he reading? He was reading them to find out the local papers, what the people thought. And he knew. And once he was to go to a meeting with me in Chicago, and I'd got him on the program, and he was to speak, see? I said, you got your speech written? No. Well, why haven't you? Well, we got to get there and see what they need. That was Heavy. But probably that one of the most best illustrators of economics that I ever knew. He could illustrate an economic principle, see, in a laughable way that they'd get.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we're down to Evansville speaking in the paper. Or speaking at Outlook meeting, forecasting the future. The guy spoke up and he says, well, that isn't in line with what was in the paper last night at all. You're different with it. Heavy says, this will be what I'm saying will be in the paper tonight. You see, that was the Heavy's great strength. Just a sentence. Everybody just roared, you know, because they knew that was true. And that guy was believing what was in the paper.
Uh-huh.
And he did it in a nice way.
Uh-huh.
And he was that kind of a fella. Delightful. Delightful. But he was a character. And of course, this is what makes a great department, is to have characters, see?
Yeah.
There was characters.
The right chemistry of personalities.
Yeah. This Hadley was, as I told you, could do anything, see? Dynamic wrestler, he was. Bauman was another of our stalwarts there. Never satisfied unless the last German, unless the last I was dotted.
B-A-U-M-A-N-N?
Yeah, B-A-U-M-A-N.
The one
Bauman.
Bauman.
His son is now over in the staff in plant pathology, Tom Bauman.
What was Bauman's first name?
Ronald, R-O-N-A-L-D.
Ronald Bauman.
Yeah. I worked with Ronald a lot. He was charged for alcohol for quite a long spell. Very, very solid. Ronald helped us in a policy. Just to illustrate, Ronald went out and we'd have two speakers. He spoke, see. Got through then, there was no questions. And he was, at night we were analyzing, going over our programs, how we could improve them. He said, didn't get any questions.
Why?
Heavy says, you had everything, every I dotted and everything closed. You didn't leave any openings for him. Now Heavy would go out and he'd give the speech and he would leave the thing openings that was big enough to drive four horses and a load of hay through. And pretty soon they'd be in on him and just having a heck of a good discussion, see?
Uh-huh.
And he knew he was leaving those holes, but he'd leave them in such a way he didn't make him wrong, see? He just didn't cover that.
Uh-huh. To draw people out.
To draw people out. Uh-huh. And this would be just so funny, they'd just be in a dither with him. And I remember he was down giving the outlook at Bedford once, and there was 250 there. And there was a drunk got in the audience. And the drunk was trying to establish that rabbits ought to be paid for by the government as a enterprise for him to earn something. They had a program there, see, for. And he kept coming back, and Heavy, what was the outlook for rabbits? And Heavy says, I don't know. How did he put that? I've forgotten it. He says, I don't know. I shoot rabbits. I don't raise them. And I remember once the fellow got a big argument about leather. And Heavy says, why, his shoe, he pulled up his shoe and had a big hole in it. Show him it answered the question. He was always doing things like that. Well, the crowd would just enjoy it today much.
And, sure.
But it was a great teaching device. Mm-hmm. So he was good at that. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, good.
I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Well, it's been an enjoyable experience. I think it's kind of rough and I'm kind of ashamed of it, but then you get something out of it.
This is going to come out extremely well. It's been a privilege, it really has. And
I told my son in Chicago, the one that's with the bank last night, he called me. And what I was doing with you. And he says, say, can I get a copy?
Yes.
Now, can I get a copy when I get through?
You bet.
Well, that'd be great.
Certainly.
Yeah, all right.
Certainly.
Because they've been after me to write my personal history, you know, and I haven't done it. And this will give them a little bit of my work. Side.
Certainly.
Yeah.
There's no question. Thank you very much, Professor J. Carroll Bottom.
Thank you.